Welcome to the Nancy McKinley Lecture Series on Autism Spectrum Disorders. We are friends and colleagues who honor Nancy's life by dedicating this series of lectures to her. Nancy passed away from pancreatic cancer on January 8, 2005. You might remember Nancy as the owner and CEO of Thinking Publications. This was her company that was committed to only publishing materials that would make a difference in the lives of individuals. She grew Thinking Publications from a single book to a multi-million dollar company. Nancy's real passion was to support adolescents with language disorders. In fact, she spoke internationally on this topic with her focus on how to help them be successful and independent adults. Over her lifetime, Nancy received numerous awards, all recognizing her dedication, her leadership, and her vision. She was loved and admired by hundreds of university students, by professionals in the field, and of course, by her employees. She was an amazing woman with endless energy. In addition to presenting and publishing, she actively empowered women to take on and be successful in leadership roles. She was involved in numerous activities in her community and in her profession in this regard. Nancy was never afraid of a good challenge. She loved to laugh, and when she laughed out loud. Outside in her gardens, she could make just about anything grow. She helped people grow, too. This virtual conference is dedicated to continuing Nancy's work in helping you grow in your lifelong learning. Please join us this week and in future years as we offer you a garden of choices on current and relevant topics and evidence-based practices. Enjoy the presentations.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Nancy McKinley Lecture Series focusing on Autism Spectrum Disorders and Asperger's Syndrome. All of the events this week are in cooperation with the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, and we are very pleased that you could join us today. I'm very excited to share with you an interview that Linda Schreiber and Chris Rutherford conducted with the highly accomplished Temple Grandin entitled Autism and My Sensory-Based World. My name is Amy Hansen, and I will be your moderator for this online course. Before we begin, I'd like to review a few of our online classroom tools and procedures. First, if you are experiencing any difficulties with the sound or the visual display, please feel free to contact us at the number provided on your screen, 1-800-242-5183. You can also text message your technical questions in the chat box that's located on the left-hand side of your screen. Simply type your question in the open text field and hit the return button to submit. Please be sure to include a telephone number where you can be reached so that a speechpathology.com representative can follow up with you if needed. If you're interested in earning CEUs for today's presentation, you do need to be logged into the event for the entire time. Once the presentation is complete, an email will be sent to your inbox within 24 hours for you to complete a short multiple choice exam reviewing the content discussed today. We ask that you allow about 3 hours before logging into your personal account to take the exam so that our system has enough time to check attendance records. Remember that you must earn an 80% or higher on the exam in order to earn your CEUs, and you will be given 2 attempts to earn a passing score. If you are looking for academic credit for promotion, licensure, or lane changes, Total Access members can earn graduate or undergraduate university credit for selected virtual conferences through the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Undergraduate credit is $375 and graduate credit is $575. For more information, there is an email listed on the screen, or feel free to call the toll-free number also listed on the bottom of your screen. Please register by February 15th to earn spring 2011 credit. If you are interested in becoming a peer reviewer for today's course or other courses in our library, please feel free to contact Amy Natho at anatho@speechpathology.com for further details. We basically ask that you have at least 3 years of professional experience in the clinical area that is under review. If you are new to our online learning platform, you do have the ability to ask questions during today's presentation. To ask a question, please use the chat box on the left-hand side of your screen by placing your cursor in the open text field, typing your question, and then click on the Enter button to submit your question. And finally, to access today's presentation handouts, place your cursor over the document you'd like to download that's located in the handouts pod, and then click on the Save to My Computer button. And at this time, it is very much a pleasure and an honor to introduce our interview with Dr. Grandin this afternoon.
I am so honored this morning to introduce to everyone Dr. Temple Grandin. Dr. Grandin is a past member of the Board of Directors of the Autism Society of America. She lectures to parents and teachers throughout the U.S. on her experiences with autism. Articles and interviews have appeared in the New York Times and People magazine, on National Public Radio, The View, and the BBC. She was also honored in Time magazine as the 2010 one of the 100 most influential people in the world. We are extremely honored to have Dr. Grandin join us here today from Fort Collins, Colorado, where she is currently professor at Colorado State University. So good morning, Dr. Grandin.
Good morning, and it's really good to be here.
We are so happy to have you. We're very interested in your views on autism, and I know you have a program set for us this morning, and we're going to just let you begin.
Well, it's wonderful to be here today on audio, and I think I'll just start out with my program. And I can't emphasize enough the importance of early educational intervention. If you have a young autistic 2-, 3-, or 4-year-old child that's just sitting in the corner rocking, the worst thing that you can do is nothing. You've got to start working with this child. I know there's situations where parents may be on a waiting list for a diagnosis, you know, that might be a year or maybe even 2 years away. Don't wait. Get some students, get some grandmothers, get anybody to just start working, interacting with that child, playing games with them. Teach them how to take turns. Play little turn-taking games. Autistic kids resist that. That was taught to me with board games. You know, do nursery rhymes. Teach them words, but work with them. Because the research is very clear. These young children need 20 to 30 hours a week of one-to-one instruction with an effective teacher. Now, there's a lot of controversy on exactly which program you use, but everybody agrees that you need that 20 to 30 hours a week of one-to-one contact with an effective teacher. We can go to the next slide. It just shows a teacher grabbing a little kid by the chin, and my speech teacher used to do this with me, and she'd say, now, come on, pay attention. A good teacher has to be gently insistent. Now, if you push too hard, then the child may go into sensory overload. And if that happens, you're not going to get anywhere. You know, how do you know kind of how hard to push? Well, there's some kids, if you take them into the big supermarkets, like a Walmart or someplace like that, it's a screaming fit. He feels like he's inside the speaker at the rock and roll concert. Some of those kids are mono-channel. They're not able to see and hear at the same time. They can either listen to something or they can hear something, but they cannot do them both at the same time. Slide just shows some of the different labels where you have problems with the sensory system. You know, sensory problems, problems with sound sensitivity, problems with not tolerating touch or visual sensitivity go across many different labels. Autism, dyslexia, learning problems, ADHD, Asperger's, head injuries, oppositional defiant. Now, these labels are not precise. They are behavioral profiles. It's not precise, like having a lab test that shows that you have tuberculosis. And in the DMS-5, when they finally changed the diagnostic guidelines, the Asperger's, which is the mild autism with no speech delay, will just be merged into autism spectrum disorder, with the main emphasis being on the problems with social reciprocity, back and forth social, fixated interests, and repetitive behaviors. On the slide, it shows a little boy putting his hands over his ears, because certain sounds hurt his ears. When I was a little kid, loud sounds like a, you know, a smoke alarm going off. Well, we didn't have smoke alarms in the 50s, so it would have been the school bell. When that went off, that was like a dentist drill hitting a nerve. And the kinds of sounds that tend to be the worst are the high-pitched things, like the smoke alarms. And you could sometimes desensitize some of these things, but the child has to initiate the sound. In other words, you might take the smoke alarm and wrap it up in five layers of towels, and the child can reach inside and turn it on, and then gradually you take the towels off, you know, where the sound gets less and less muted. And sometimes you can desensitize these things when the child initiates it, and sometimes you cannot. My next talks about auditory testing. You go in and you do the standard hearing test where they hear the little faint sounds. They will pass that hearing test unless the ears are full of fluid or some problem like that. But most autistic kids will pass it, and so they're not deaf. But the thing is, auditory threshold is not the same thing as hearing auditory detail. This is the ability to hear the hard consonant sounds, like D for dog, B for boy, T for toy. And so my speech teacher would enunciate the hard consonant sounds. She would hold up a cup and she'd say cuppa, you know, or hold up a picture of a dog and say dogga, you know, slow down, enunciate those sounds. Now there's some kids that are echolalic where they the speech just comes flowing out of them and they know all these TV commercials and all these videos and things like that, but they have no idea what it means. And some of these echolalic kids that are just singing all these commercials may try to do a commercial for a food restaurant when it's dinner time. They might sing a McDonald's commercial at dinner time because they know that that's associated with food. And the echolalic kids can learn language with hundreds of flashcards. And you've got to have the picture of the thing and the word on the same side of the card. And some of those cards were shown in the HBO movie. There was a picture of a dog on a card, and then it said dog underneath it. The picture and the word must be on the same side of the card, and they're going to just start learning how to pick the words out of conversation. The next talks about attention shifting slowness. One of the big problems you have in many disorders is it takes much longer to shift back and forth between two different stimuli. Like, for example, let's say a mobile phone rings. That attracts the child's attention. It takes much longer for him to shift back to what he's doing. Attention shifting is very slow. And you can sometimes get a phenomenon called clipping, where I might ask a child to hang up his coat, and he might just hear coat, and the words hang up were clipped. So what you want to do is get his attention first and say, Tommy, I need to ask you to do something. Now I've got the channel open. Then you say, hang up your coat. The next shows some work that was done by Ami Quinn at Yale, and they had people on the autism spectrum watch a movie, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? A really social kind of movie I find really boring, actually. And you can see the yellow line, the normal person, looks at the people's eyes. And I didn't even know that people had all these secret little eye signals until I read about them in a book when I was 50 years old. And the autistic is looking at the mouths. Because remember, they don't hear that well, even though the auditory threshold is really good, and they can hear the faint sound of their favorite video, you know, like across from the neighbor's house. That doesn't mean that they can hear auditory detail. Also, this slide illustrates attention-shifting slowness. Look at how the yellow line shifts back and forth much more quickly, many different times. That yellow line is switched back and forth looking at the two people, and the autistic hasn't even switched back and forth once. It beautifully shows attention-shifting slowness. On my next, it shows how a visual image can fragment and break up. Some people on the spectrum, and also I want to emphasize, these sensory problems can happen with many different diagnostic labels. I cannot emphasize that enough. And there's some people where the images break up, especially when they're tired. All these sensory things get worse when a child is tired. I'm sure you've all seen when the satellite dish is shaking, then the image pixelates and it gets all messed up and it has like little spots all over it. Well, that's sort of like how the visual system can malfunction in some people. I don't have this problem because if I had this problem, I wouldn't be a visual thinker. People that have this problem tend to prefer the auditory sense. They're going to learn more over auditory. I can't emphasize how variable sensory issues are. One kid may have a lot of sound sensitivity. Another kid may have touch sensitivity. Some kids are under-reactive to stimulation. Another kid will have visual problems. And these visual problems are inside the brain. They're not in the eye itself. They're in the brain. See, in your brain, you have circuits for color, shape, motion, and texture. They're separate circuits in the brain. And they have to work together to form images, to make that graphics file. Something's wrong with that system that binds these systems together. It's called the binding problem in vision research. Scientists have absolutely no idea how it works, but they know that these circuits do have to work together, and if they don't work together, then you get these scrambled up images. The next slide just lists signs that a child may have something wrong with his visual system. Even though the eye exam, especially a little quick eye exam, looking in, they'll take the thing and look at the retina, that may be just fine. Kids that do a lot of finger flicking around the eyes tilt their head when they read because they can see better with the peripheral vision, and they often hate fluorescent lights. That's the big one, 60-cycle fluorescent lights. You know, the regular old-fashioned kind, they can see them flickering like a discotheque. Now, there are some new electronic fluorescent lights that have a higher frequency. Those may be okay, and I'm not sure about the new LED lights that are coming in. You know, there's new technologies coming in, but the old-fashioned 60-cycle fluorescent lights are absolutely terrible. And people ask me, what would you do if you were designing a school for, kids with learning problems? Get rid of 60-cycle fluorescent lights. That would be my big number one important thing to do. May have difficulty catching a ball, and little quickie eye exams are normal. Now, my next slide shows what print looks like to somebody that has a visual processing problem. You can see how the print is kind of wiggling and jiggling on the page. And this problem is common. I have a class in livestock handling where my students have to draw drawings, and I have about 2 students out of 60 every semester that have this problem. And I can tell they have the problem because they absolutely cannot draw. These kids cannot draw. Drawing is not going to be their talent area. The next shows simple interventions that you can do for visual processing problems. Okay, let's say you're stuck in that classroom that's got those old-fashioned fluorescent lights. Well, if you got windows, get that kid's desk over by the window. If you don't have windows, then put a 100-watt old-fashioned incandescent light next to the kid's desk, the old-fashioned energy waster kind of bulb, because those don't flicker. You might try having them wear a hat. Also, get the right computer screen. The old TV-type computers flicker. They're absolutely terrible. Some of the flat panels flicker and some don't, but the one kind of screen that absolutely does not flicker is the laptop. And I had a dyslexic student, and she would have flunked out of school and failed her classes if she hadn't had her laptop. And try printing the homework on colored paper, maybe light blue paper, light tan paper, light lavender, all the pale colors. And you've got to find the pale color that works for the child. And for each child, it's going to be different. And then another helpful thing are Erwin colored lenses. Those are simply colored glasses, and you try on all those different colors like pale pink, pale lavender, pale yellow, pale gray, pale tan. You try on all these different colors until you find the color where the print no longer jiggles. And the only advantage of the Erwin lenses is you can get them the precise exact color. But I know a lot of people who have gone down to the local store and they bought some glasses and they found glasses that worked. I remember one family where their little kid could only tolerate 5 minutes at the local supermarket. And after they had bought some little pink glasses, some like Disneyland glasses, their child could do an hour of shopping at the supermarket. It costs nothing to try this. I'm talking about going in a store and trying on sunglasses. And you want to get the pale colors. I mean, I'm from the 60s, and we used to call those hippie glasses. And, you just have to just shop around and find a color that works. It's, nobody knows why they work, but they help a lot of people. But I want to emphasize, not everybody with autism has these problems. Maybe only 10% of the people that have autism have these problems. But I'm talking about trying on glasses at a local store. It doesn't even cost anything. And if it worked, it can be very, very helpful. I just talked about some of the severe sensory problems. I cannot hear when there's background noise. And just the other day, I downloaded a journal article off of PubMed, that documented the problem with hearing when there's background noise. In fact, if you want to look up a lot of things, the PubMed database is wonderful. That's PubMed. It stands for Public Medicine, PubMed. Type that into Google and then click on the first link that says PubMed Home. That takes you into search box in the National Library of Medicine, and you can look up all kinds of stuff on autism and veterinary stuff, anything to do with medical things. Also, a person with autism is often mono-channel, and in some of the ones with more severe sensory problems, they have body boundary problems. They can't tell where their hand starts and the desk begins. Often they're auditory thinkers. And if you have an older child that's nonverbal, I'd strongly recommend you get this book by Tito Mukhopadhyay, How Can I Talk If My Lips Don't Move? And he describes a world of sensory scrambling. That will give you a really good glimpse into how the nonverbal person's with autism mind works. And then I have my own books, Thinking in Pictures and the Way I See It. Of course, I'm going to recommend my own books to people, too, because I cover a lot of things in there. Let's just go on to the next slide. Scientists have learned a lot of things about the brain. There's a lot that's known. One of the basic principles is the frontal cortex of the brain is used less. And thinking tends to be more in the back, rear parts of the brain, back in the visual parts of the brain. Basically, I think with the visual parts of the brain. And also, some recent research that was done on me showed that my amygdala was 3 times larger than normal. That's the brain's fear center. And that would explain why I was so anxious all the time. Some people on autism would be very, very, very anxious. Others are not. I was saved by taking a low dose of an antidepressant drug because it stopped my constant anxiety and panic attacks. Then there's other people on the spectrum where antidepressants don't work at all. In fact, what a recent meta-analysis showed that for people on the autism spectrum, the one antidepressant that really works better than all the others is Prozac. But you have to use it in very low doses. Too high a dose, you're going to get agitation and insomnia. And in my book, Thinking in Pictures, I go into a lot more detail about the use of medication. The next slide just shows some brain scans. And you can see there that when you see a word, think about a word, hear about a word, or speak a word, different parts of the brain are turned on. Well, those different parts of the brain have to work together in order to have, in order for the brain to work right. And one of the big problems you have in autism is difficulties in the inter-office communication between the different parts of the brain. The way the brain is set up, it has departments, sort of like a big office building. And you go to the next slide, and there's a picture of a great big office building. But then you have all these different departments. The brain is compartmentalized. But then half of your brain consists of white matter, and those are the inter-office communications that connect the different parts of the brain together. And this is where you have the abnormalities. Like here at the top of the office building, you've got the president and the chief executive officer. That's your frontal cortex. And then you get down to division vice president level. That's where language is. Then underneath that, you've got all the good geek and techie stuff. That's visual thinking, mathematics, music, all that kind of wonderful stuff. And then a little further down, you've got the emotion center to stir things up. And then you've got incoming data lines. And there's often lots of trouble on the incoming data lines. But where the main abnormality is there's just not very many circuits going up to those suits up there in the upstairs office. But sometimes, in some people, there may be extra circuits, like maybe down in the math department, and that might account for something like math savant skills. Because one of the basic principles in autism is it's often an area of skill and an area of deficit. Another big problem in dealing with the autism spectrum is it's such a big spectrum, going all the way from geniuses out in Silicon Valley and maybe someone like Einstein or someone like Mr. Zuckerman, from Facebook. It's a big continuum going from geniuses that are not very social to people that are nonverbal and are certainly not going to be doing anything out in Silicon Valley. It's a huge continuum. And it is a true continuum. This slide kind of shows the inter-office communications between different parts of the brain. It's sort of like an airline route map. And on the east coast of this chart, kind of on the right-hand side, you've got New York and Washington, D.C. and those kind of places. And then you got Chicago in the middle, that's the amygdala. And then out on the West Coast, you've got Silicon Valley. And what tends to happen is a bunch of flights get canceled up and down the East Coast, and a bunch of flights get canceled to Chicago. And this may account for some of the problems with emotional control, like sometimes get rage attacks and things like that, because there's less top-down control to the amygdala. But there also may be extra circuits out on the West Coast, and that may account, for some of the intelligence and things like art and mathematics, music, and some of those sorts of things. But autism is a true continuum. The next slide shows some beautiful horses, and these were done by a patient that had frontal temporal lobe dementia. And as the language parts of the brain were wrecked, art ability came out. You see, things like art may be hidden underneath language. The next slide shows a perspective drawing done by a 9-year-old. You know, kids that are visual thinkers will often spontaneously just start drawing. And these skills will often show up around third or fourth grade. I get asked by parents all the time, how can I tell what kind of a thinker my child is? Well, you can't usually tell in kindergarten. Sometimes you can tell, but usually it's more around third or fourth grade. And the kid's like, 7, 8 years old, that's when it shows up. And the visual thinkers, they're going to draw. They're going to love to draw things. And if the child just wants to draw airplanes all the time, let's try to broaden that out. Let's draw some places where airplanes go. Let's draw the airport. Let's draw an airplane hangar. Let's draw a catering truck that brings food to the airplane. In other words, broaden out those interests. You can take those fixated interests and use them to motivate. He likes airplanes. Let's read about airplanes. Let's do math about airplanes. Let's read about the history of aviation. And this slide shows movie reels inside a little kid's head. And my thinking basically is pictures in my mind. And the HBO movie beautifully showed how my mind thinks in pictures. There's a scene in there where the word shoe is said, and a bunch of shoes just come up in rapid succession in my mind. That's exactly how I think. The movie is very clinically accurate on showing sensory issues, on showing anxiety, my speech patterns. They did a really good job on making sure that those parts were accurate. Also, they showed all my projects really accurately. All the things that were built in the movie were accurate. Now, there were some things that were fictionalized, but the stuff with sensory certainly was not. So the next slide, it shows a picture of one of my cattle handling facilities. And when I design a piece of equipment, I can test run it in my head. I didn't know that other people couldn't do that. Next slide shows the dip vat system that HBO built for the movie, and that really turned me on. Next slide just shows the drawings that I did back in the 70s for the dip vat, and they built it right off of these drawings. And the way I sold jobs, since I was weird, is I'd show people my drawings. I had to sell my work, not myself. This is a really important thing in employment, is making portfolios. You show off your work. If you're good at programming, then you show off some of your code. If you're good at art, you show off some of your art. If you're good at writing, you show off some samples of maybe some newsletters that you wrote. I sold my work and not myself. We can go to the next drawing there. That just shows the aerial view of the dip vat. Love to show my drawings off. The next drawing shows a circular handling facility up in Canada. And I just love to fantasize that someday, 1,000 years in the future, they're going to dig this up and they're going to wonder what it was for. And I just think that's kind of interesting. The next slide shows a picture of a little boy with boxes in his head. And this was written by the son of Karen Simmons. And it's in a book called Little Rain Man. And he's sorting cat and dog pictures into little boxes. That's how the autistic brain thinks. Sorting images into different file folders. It's bottom-up thinking. My concept of what a dog is based on a whole lot of dog pictures I have put in the dog file. My concept of what a house is put in a bunch of, in a file folder labeled house and apartment building. I'm seeing a different set of pictures for apartment building. Condo, I see a slightly different kind of set of pictures than I do for just house. The next slide just says, I realized my thinking was different when I asked people about church steeples. And this is something I did back in the mid-90s when I wrote Thinking in Pictures. Because when I say church steeple, I just see a whole lot of specific ones. The next slide just shows what I found out when I questioned people. I was just shocked to find out that most people see this generalized, generic sort of church steeple. You know, it's a generalized one. And what's been learned now in the brain science is that that generalized steeple is coming out of the association cortex. I'm going all the way back into primary visual cortex. You know, I'd say about, you know, half the people see these generalized pictures, especially on something that they don't kind of, you know, they don't own one. If I ask you about your home or your car or your dog, you usually you'll visualize specific. But something like steeples, something you don't own, but you see them every day, you tend to see generalized. I only specific steeples. They flash up into my memory like Google's pictures. You can go through that slide. Now you can kind of just click through fast the slides on the steeples. We can click through my childhood church, churches of Collins on another slide, the Mormon Temple. Then you can click through a picture of Old North Church in Boston and Notre Dame and then Westminster Abbey. You can just kind of click through those slides pretty quickly, and that is how they flash up into my mind. Okay, the next slide I want to get to is some of my brain scans. I used to joke around that I had a huge internet line going deep into my visual cortex. Well, Dr. Nancy Minshew at the University of Pittsburgh and her colleagues did some scans on me, and they found that I had a huge internet trunk line going deep into my primary visual cortex. That would explain my visual thinking. When I saw that, wow. The next slide shows that was taken with a slice through my forehead, and you can see that I've got a really big one on the right-hand side. And when I saw these pictures, they were a real mind-blower. And then some other research over at the University of Utah has shown that my entorhinal cortex, that's part of the brain's graphics card, that is also really, really, really huge. And then I do have a defect in my parietal cortex, and that would explain my problems with math. Doing algebra, that was absolutely impossible. This next slide's really important because it talks about specialized thinking types. I'm a photorealistic thinker. I think in photorealistic specific pictures. Absolutely could not do algebra. And I'm finding there's some kids that cannot do algebra, but they can do geometry. They can do trig. And kids that are not able to do algebra need to be allowed to go on to geometry and trig. Then another kind of mind is the pattern thinker. It's a more abstract visual thinking. These are the kids that are good at math. They're often good at music. In fact, I was just reading a recent scientific article that showed that playing musical instruments and doing things with music actually helps kids to learn mathematics. I think it's a real shame that so many schools have taken out art and music and woodshop and sewing and all of these kind of hands-on things. Now, the kids that are good at math are often poor at reading. And I've actually found documentation for this now in the scientific literature. This is something I've been reviewing, and I'm finding papers that support what I have on this slide. And the thing that's kind of interesting is I kind of figured out this slide long before I got into those papers. But just recently I've been digging deep into the literature to find papers, and what I say on this slide is supported by studies. And then a third type of mind is a verbal thinker. This is the Asperger kid that loves history. They're just average in math. They're just average in a lot of things. They love history, and they are not a visual thinker. They're poor at drawing. And when you look at math skills in kids with autism, there's a segment that's really superior, and there's another segment that's just average. And that's another thing that has shown up in the literature. And then there can be mixtures of these thinking types. And then you've got auditory thinkers. They are strictly an auditory person. Next slide shows a praying mantis made out of origami, out of folded paper. And well, this gives you a glimpse into the mind of the pattern thinker. That praying mantis is made out of a single sheet of folded paper, you know, with no cutting, no scotch tape. And what you see in the background, that's the folding pattern. And I've had some people criticize my slides because I don't have enough wording on them. I'm trying to get you away from words. Some of these guys, they live in a world that is not words. Next slide shows a rainbow, and at the base of the rainbow is an electric power tower. And this is my visual image for the power and the glory in the Lord's Prayer. I had absolutely no idea what it meant. You know, when they said, "Thou, thy Father up in heaven, thou art in heaven," I didn't really know what it meant. But there was one little autistic kid that thought it was God up in heaven painting on an easel making art. Thou art in heaven. And I didn't have any idea what a man had to do with the end of the, at the end of the prayer. Getting on to the next slide. This is a very important slide. All my thinking uses specific examples to create concept. It's bottom up and not top down. I cannot emphasize how important this is. This is one of the most important concepts. All concepts are learned by taking lots of different specific examples and putting them into categories. You know, the normal human mind is top down. Everything is learned with specific examples. Next picture just shows some objects that you can categorize. Okay, you can categorize these things into the red objects. You know, work with getting the child to make up new categories. You know, like, well, he can pick out the round objects. Now, he may pick up those old VHS tapes because they have round reels inside them. How about objects containing plastic? Objects that you wear? Objects you might use at work? Now, you take something like a like the ball. If you use that for a little exercise ball for your hand, then it would be used at work. If you just use it outside, then it might be used for play. You see, an object can be used for different things under different circumstances, and we need to teach kids that. The next slide shows a test that measures, you know, seeing detail. And you've got big letters that are made out of little letters. And the autistic kid will see the little letters quicker. Like if you, flash one of these letters up on the screen and you say, pick out the little letters, they'll pick out the little letters quicker than picking out the great big S. They see the detail. This slide just shows a bookcase full of lots of file folders. And people always ask me, is autistic thinking just memorization? Well, in the beginning, it is just memorization scripting. But as you get more and more and more information shoved into the kid's head, then he can start to put it into categories. When I was a real young kid, kids used to call me tape recorder. And I couldn't figure out why they called me tape recorder. And the reason why they called me tape recorder is that I always use the same phrases. But as you get kids out and you get them exposed to more and more and more stuff, then there's more information loaded into the database. It's sort of like filling up the internet. I don't know, some you know, us older people can remember when the internet was new and it didn't have much stuff in it. And then gradually more and more stuff got put in it. You've got to get these kids out, expose them to lots of interesting things. Mother was always pushing me to do new things. You know, always pushing me. And, you know, she'd give me some choices. In fact, originally I was afraid to go out to the ranch. And she told me I could go for a week or I could go for all summer. Well, I ended up choosing to stay all summer. We got to get them out doing things. And table manners were just pounded in. Okay. This slide just shows teaching math with different lengths of blocks. I had a set of these blocks, and they were very, very helpful to me. This slide just shows teaching math with little, you know, puzzle piece things. You know, you can add them up. And but I want to emphasize, you don't want to just teach math just with little plastic pieces, because then the child might think it only applies to plastic pieces. So the next slide emphasizes the importance of teaching number concepts using a variety of objects. Let's take candy. I can have five pieces of candy, and I eat two, I have three pieces of candy left. That's subtraction. Teach fractions by cutting up an apple. When you cut up a pizza, use that as a time to teach some math concepts. The next slide just shows my unwritten social skills book that I did with Sean Barron. And Sean and I are different. There's things about us that are the same. We both had fixated interests. That was very much the same. But where he was different, he had a few more social circuits hooked up, and he was very frustrated about his problems with dating, where I'm kind of a pure geek and was happy just to go out and do my building things. This slide shows in brain scans that when I was put in the brain scan and I was shown all these different pictures, pictures of people and pictures of things, I was a lot more interested in looking at pictures of things. But the thing is, we need to have people in this world that are interested in things, because we wouldn't even have electricity otherwise, because Tesla, who invented the power plant, would probably be labeled autistic today. And the next slide emphasizes the importance of getting social interaction through shared interests. You know, things like computer club, robotics club, drama club, art club, playing music. Get kids involved in these different specialized things, because this is where they're going to get friends. Where I had refuges away from teasing, and believe you me, I had lots of teasing, and it can be really damaging. I just read an article in my brand new psychiatry journal showing a really bad effects of verbal abuse on children. and you know we need to work to get teasing stopped. But when I was working on shared interests like horseback riding or model rocket club, these were places where there was no teasing. And I think it's important to get kids into these specialized interests because these are areas where they can get friends. Okay, this slide just talks about categorizing behavior problems. Okay, let's say you're working, maybe a kid that's a little more severe, and you've got a behavior problem. You know, you're having a lot of tantrums. You got to figure out, is it biology or is it behavior? Okay, your most common biological problems are sensory issues. A child is screaming because he's in sensory overload in the noisy gym. Or maybe he's screaming because he saw a smoke alarm up on the ceiling and he's afraid that it might go off and he doesn't want to be anywhere near it. It also can be just the fear of a painful stimulus. Also, hidden painful medical problems. And some of the biggest medical problems that they can have are gastrointestinal. That is a biological problem, or do I have a problem with behavior? Your most common biological problems are sensory oversensitivity. You know, a child might not be able to tolerate a noisy gym. Or maybe he doesn't want to go in that room because he sees the smoke alarm and he's afraid it might go off. Or he sees a particularly bad cell phone with a horrible ring that he's afraid might go off. Or he has a hidden painful medical problem. And some of the worst hidden painful medical problems are gastrointestinal. And that's starting to get very well documented. There's a lot of kids that have acid reflux. And they sometimes will do weird stretching behaviors because their tummy hurts, and they oftentimes don't want to sit. They don't want to lie down because their tummy hurts. They need to be treated for acid reflux, you know, heartburn. You know, get some heartburn medicine. You know, be a good detective. Maybe he's got an earache. Maybe he's got a toothache. You've got to rule these things out. And somebody that's nonverbal, you've got to make sure they don't have something medically wrong with them. Now, some examples of behavior reasons are frustration because they cannot communicate. I was so frustrated when I couldn't communicate, and I threw some tantrums over that. Sometimes you throw a big tantrum just to get attention. Other times you throw a big tantrum just to get out of doing something. You got to figure out the motivation. The next slide shows some sensory and neurological accommodations that we may have to accommodate for certain kids. Some kids may be so bad about the fire alarm that you're going to just have to take them out before the fire drill. Some are not able to tolerate a large supermarket. Now, sometimes there's some kids that when they're not tired, like when they're fresh in the morning, they might be able to tolerate that supermarket. And there's some where if you kind of make them do some of these noisy things, they can get desensitized, but there's others that never get desensitized. I can't tolerate scratchy clothes. I have real difficulty finding really comfortable things to sleep in. And different kinds of cotton T-shirts will itch. Like one 100% cotton T-shirt will itch and another one doesn't. It just has something to do with the weave. And I wear a lot of my underwear inside out. I have poor handwriting, and I think keyboards need to be introduced early. You have a kid that's 5 years old and he's got no speech. Let's get the keyboard out and start learning how to type. Because someone like Tito Mukhopadhyay looks very, very, very low functioning, but he can type. And I asked him one time what it was like before he had typing. He said it was emptiness. Okay, getting them away from fluorescent lights, that's a biggie. Also, just about everybody on the spectrum, no matter where they are, has difficulty with multitasking. I absolutely cannot multitask. If I had to work in a busy office and type and answer the phone at the same time, that would be a disaster. Another thing is I cannot remember long strings of verbal instructions. I have to write it down. That's really important for me. His upbringing really helped me. Turn-taking in conversation and activities. That was just taught, you know, in the situation. It would be at the dining room table, and I talked for too long. My mother would say, well, you've got to give somebody else time to talk. Turn-taking was also taught with board games. Play lots of board games. Being on time. That was pounded in. I got an alarm clock when I was very young, and I was expected to do it. I was expected to use it and get up on time. Doing things I was asked to do. Doing things that would please other people. Being considerate. How do you teach a concept like being considerate? Well, I remember one time I woke up my mother so she could open a little bottle of glue for me. Well, she was not happy about it. That was an example of not being considerate. When I made social mistakes, they just correct them. They didn't scream at me. They would just tell me what I was supposed to do. Like if I reached across the table too much, my mother would say, ask your sister to pass it. Also, saying please and thank you. That was just drilled in. You know, all kids were taught that in the 50s. Okay, next slide shows some bad behavior that was absolutely not tolerated, being rude. Okay, what is being rude? Well, sticking your tongue out is rude. So if I did that, I was told that was rude. You know, I went in the 50s, you didn't call grown-ups by their first name. You know, that would be rude. You know, bad table manners. Also, there was absolutely consistent discipline between home and school. The rules were the same at home and school. Parents and teachers have got to work together on those sort of things. Poor grooming, I was a real slob on that. And there's a scene in the movie where the deodorant is slammed down on the table, and that actually happened. And I, when I think back on it, I thank my boss for doing that. You know, laughing at somebody that's overweight, that's rude behavior. You know, these are the things that Mother made very clear to me were not okay. This slide just shows some shows Sheldon from Big Bang Theory and a couple kids with tie-dyed shirts. It's fine to be eccentric. I think it's fine to be eccentric. Don't try to de-geek the geek. You're not going to make me into something that I'm not. But a filthy, dirty, rude slob, that is something I absolutely, you know, you got to get that cleaned up, like the guy that doesn't shave. Okay, if you don't like the shaving cream, then get an electric razor. But you're going to have to either shave or grow a beard. Do one or the other. There's a rule system that I still live with today. You know, you wouldn't have a civilized society if you had people doing really bad things all the time, like killing people, burning down buildings, and stealing everything. Then you have courtesy rules. They help people get along. And then you have some places to break some rules, like maybe some stupid school rules. You know, like the kid's too young to go to the community college. Well, you sign them up anyway. And then there's rules where you have draconian penalties, and especially in this post-September 11th age, there's things that used to be just naughty boys games now get you into 10 tons of trouble. Little sexual transgressions can get you on the sex offender list and really wreck your life. Those are sins of the system, and boy, you don't touch those. And when I was in high school, it was sex, alcohol, and smoking. And I found I could get away with lots of illegals, but not bad, like riding my horse out in the pasture without a staff member being present, if I could be trusted on the three sins of the system. I figured this out really early. Well, teaching values, so the next slide just shows that in the 50s, the movies had much better values. They were very clear values about right and wrong, and that's something that's not being taught today. The next slide just shows some hidden, painful medical problems. Okay, I already talked about the acid reflux and the heartburn. How about constipation? How about urinary tract infections, yeast infections? Boy, I've had yeast infections. They're miserable. One of the ways to control those, if you've got to go on a real low-carb diet to control yeast infections, ear infections, toothaches, you've got to rule this stuff out. You might have a child that's been acting good, now all of a sudden he's acting bad. You've got to make sure, especially if they're nonverbal, they don't have a hidden painful medical problem. Now, the next slide shows my squeezing machine. And when I got into puberty, I started having these horrible panic attacks, just all the time, constant fear. Well, now I know why I had constant fear. Well, my fear center was three times bigger than normal and still is today, even after being on antidepressants for 30 years. But the squeeze machine helped my anxiety. Another thing that helps anxiety is exercise. We've got to get these kids out exercising. We've got to get all the sugar and the junk out of their diets. And there are some kids that are helped by things like the wheat-free and the dairy-free diet. It's just a subgroup. But some of these kids that have all these digestive problems, they're the ones that may need that diet. And some of these kids actually have celiac disease. I just got finished doing a lot of surfing on PubMed and on all over the Internet over Christmas vacation. That was really kind of fun. But getting tons of sugar out and getting a lot more exercise will really help. And there's mixed evidence on the omega-3s. I mean, for some, I think that may be helpful, especially if they're getting a real omega-3, you know, low diet. Okay, the next slide just shows fear is the main emotion in autism. And boy, that is certainly true for me. And rear view picture of the squeezing machine. And the next slide just shows simple ways to do deep pressure in little kids. I mean, the real little kids, you don't have to have an expensive squeezing machine. It'd be nice to have. But you can do it with just simple things, like getting onto mattresses, getting onto sofa cushions. And some kids crave pressure, and other kids are not very interested in pressure. This is where autistic kids are different. And when you're doing this pressure, maybe do some speech therapy or do some ABA right at the same time. Because when you do some of these sensory interventions, it sometimes opens up the channel. Because some of their these kids, their hearing is like a bad mobile phone. And then when you take your phone outside, it works. You know, and when you do some of these sensory things, it's sort of like taking your phone outside, and all of a sudden the bad phone gets better, and their hearing stops cutting in and out. But you want to do it for only 20 minutes at a time. You do it for 20 minutes, and then you get it off. I want to emphasize that not every child reacts well to deep pressure. You want to do this on the kids that are the deep pressure responders. And this is why in the literature you get so many mixed results, because they're just assigning subjects by a diagnosis of autism rather than assigning subjects treatment based on what kind of sensory problems they have. The next slide just shows a therapist, an occupational therapist, swinging a child slowly on a swing. And sometimes you can get some speech out when you do this. And some of these kids, if you get them to sing, they can sometimes sing words before they can speak them. So do a lot of nursery rhymes and things like that, because that can get them singing and talking. Here's a little kid wearing a weighted vest. And some kids respond really well to weighted vests, and others do not. And the next slide talks about the importance of getting kids so they'll tolerate hugging and affection. You need to work on desensitizing them. You're not going to get wool against my skin, but it is possible to get these kids that don't want to be hugged desensitized to deep pressure. You just have to be kind of gently insistent, and it's going to help them to develop feelings of kindness. The next slide just talks about preparing for employment. We've got to get teenagers doing jobs. I'm seeing too many kids that get all the way to college and they have never done any work stuff. You know, kids in middle school, they need to be walking dogs for people. I know there's no paper routes anymore, and I think that's a real shame. Mowing lawns, shoveling sidewalks. Another really good job for middle schoolers is fixing other people's computers, because a lot of them are very good with computers. And when that neighbor calls, when their computer's crashed, they're going to have to go and fix it. But they need to be getting these work skills. The movie also showed my science teacher really well. And when I was in high school, I was just goofing around. I wasn't interested in studying. And a good teacher can really get a kid turned around. And oftentimes, it's going to be the shop teacher or the science teacher. And I think it's such a shame that we have a shortage of these kind of teachers. And there's way too many drugs being given out to kids. I just looked at some recent data on that, and they're just like drugging, especially boys. It's just, I saw a disgusting graph where the amount of psychiatric drugs being given out to young boys is just absolutely revolting. You know, we need to be getting them more exercise, get a lot of sugar and garbage out of their diet, and get them interested in classes they're going to get interested in. Take them out and visit interesting places. You know, visit factories if possible. Visit farms. There's all kinds of interesting places. Bring trade journals into class. There's all kinds of great science websites. I was just looking at a wonderful website called Fold It, and it's a video game. But you actually do real science on protein folding. You actually results from Fold It go into scientific journals. There's a wonderful mathematics site called Wolfram Mathematica. There's just some really really great science websites and math websites. Get kids interested in those things. Take them out, and they got to get out and see stuff. Also, another thing I learned is I had to sell my work and not myself. Lots of times the parents can teach their kid their profession. Any job that's on a computer, that's done on a computer, can be taught to a kid in middle school. We don't have any health and safety issues with that. Obviously, we can't have work in a factory, but if the parent's job involves a computer, the kid can be taught how to do that job. We've got to start emphasizing what are you going to do when you grow up. The next slide shows our ugly ski toe house and how I fixed it all up. And, of course, I got really fixated on the ski toe house, but I didn't go decorating it with cattle. I decorated it in a way that other people would like. This is really, really important. We've got to start teaching these skills. The slide just shows Lego Mindstorms. This is another really, really great activity to get kids involved in, but the kid is going to learn how to work with another kid to make a robot. You know, like maybe one kid does the programming, the other kid does the mechanical parts. Also, they need to learn that they have to make a robot to do an assigned task. This is really important. They've got to learn how to use their creativity to do an assigned task. The same thing needs to be done with drawing and with mathematics and with programming. They've got to learn how to do an assigned task. I'd always like to show off my drawings. That always turns people on. And early on, when I went to my first agricultural engineering meeting, people thought it was really weird. But when I whipped out one of these drawings, I got respect. The next slide just shows one of my facilities done in Google SketchUp. Google SketchUp, that's another really cool thing. It's a three-dimensional drawing program. You can download the beginner's version free off the Internet. There's a lot of people around that are now getting retired. They could teach some of these kids programming, teach them engineering skills. We've got to start getting these boys engaged. I'm really horrified at what's going on with some of these boys. And the amount of powerful drugs given out like candy to five-year-olds, I'm absolutely, totally horrified in the amount of powerful drugs being given out. Now, there's some older children and adults that need medication. I was one of the ones that needed antidepressants, and they work very well for anxiety. And there's questions about whether they work for depression. Prozac works absolutely fantastic for anxiety. I know a lot of visual thinkers that would be on drugs and alcohol if they weren't on a little tiny dab of Prozac every day. Really turned their life around. And I know three people that had their life turned around by that. All right, let's get into our educational resources. Community colleges. That's where a lot of the good teachers are that would be like Mr. Carlock, my science teacher. In fact, he got honorary doctorate for the movie. But the Mr. Carlocks aren't in the high schools because they're not accredited teachers. He was a NASA space scientist, but they're often out at the community colleges, the technical schools. There's online learning. Some of these kids that are being tortured with teasing need to be maybe finishing up high school online. The slide just shows really great science websites, and you can read that. I don't have to read that. On to the next slide. And you've got to show kids interesting things. And that's a scene from the titles of the HBO movie. And I was shown a movie of this optical illusion room, and I got really fixated on that, and I built one. That's an example of showing kids interesting stuff. Okay, the next slide shows the HBO movie crew. And there were a lot of people with Asperger's down there on that movie crew. Now, I'm not going to say what jobs they were doing because I cannot identify them, but how do they get these jobs? This is through the back door. We got to figure out how to get through the back door, where you can show the portfolio. You know somebody that can get you in, because front door interviewing doesn't work. You've got to get the portfolio shown to the technical people or the writing people. You know, let's say a kid's good at writing. Well, then maybe he needs to write for the church newsletter, write for a neighborhood newsletter. He's got to start doing things to build up a portfolio. The next slide shows the Swift plant where I started my career. And there's a scene in the movie where I had a chance meeting with a lady, and that got me into the Swift plant. And we had to call it Abbott because Swift still exists, so they had to use a fake name. But there are these chance meetings. They can be a door, and you got to see that door. Okay, the last few slides, I'm going to go over jobs for different kinds of thinkers. And this slide shows good jobs for visual thinkers like me. And what I do with cattle handling equipment, that's industrial design. That's a great field. There's college majors in industrial design. In fact, one of my brother's kids is majoring in industrial design right now. He's a visual thinker like me. Computer network specialist that does hardware, graphic arts, animation, architectural drafting, auto mechanics. There's a lot of these boys. They'd be great auto mechanics. But you need to expose them to auto mechanics or they're not going to get interested in it. Fixing computers, a photographer, animal trainer, architecture. Get them exposed to these jobs. You know, we need to start exposing them in middle school. I mean, something like architecture that's done on a computer, well, a middle school kid can start learning that. If it's done on a computer, a middle school kid can start learning a job because we don't have any problems with OSHA or with safety if it's done on a computer. Okay, the next slide shows jobs for the pattern thinkers, the music and math thinkers. And the big ones are engineering, physics, and computer programming. And a lot of these kids are getting addicted to video games, and that's all they're doing all day, playing video games. Well, let's get them interested in programming a video game. But the problem is that for every kid there'd be a good programmer, there's 10 others that are just video game addicts. We've got to limit the video game playing to an hour a day. If they want to program the game, that's fine, spend 8 hours a day on it, but playing it, it's 1 hour a day. Let's go on to verbal thinkers. These are the guys that love the history. You know, some of these would make good special education teachers. They make good speech therapists. They'd be good journalists. They'd be good at language translation, good at anything to do with record keeping, doing legal research in a lawyer's office. They'd be good at that. And I don't want to get into bad jobs for people with autism. One of the biggest problems is the multitasking and remembering long strings of verbal details. And my final slide before we end up, and I'll leave 5 minutes here for questions, is jobs for people with poor verbal skills. There's lots of jobs, stocking shelves, shelving books in the library. I need to take data entry off of that. That's been pretty well made obsolete now. Working in a recycling plant, inventory control. Some of them are good at handcrafts and art. You know, we need to be getting much more of a mindset when kids get into middle school of what are they going to do when they grow up. And when I was in high school and goofing all around and not studying, I was learning a lot of good work skills. I took care of 9 horses. That gate that was shown in the movie, I actually built that, and that was done when I was 15 years old. We've got to get thinking in that mindset. And we now have 5 minutes left for some questions.
Oh, so informative. Thank you so much, Temple. A couple of questions I had. You mentioned how important it is to be a part of a social group. I wondered how you felt about online social groups such as Facebook and how that might either be an advantage or a disadvantage for kids.
I think Facebook's really, really a wonderful thing, but I think they need some social interaction with live people, you know, like be in a choir. Do artwork together, be a robotics mindstorms, do in band. You know, you have all the different things you can do in high school. I think it's important for them to learn how to work with other people doing an activity. I think Facebook's a great thing. I'm all for it, but I don't think that replaces doing live activities. And we also need to be doing a lot more daily living things, like just going out to a restaurant. I mean, I found a kid that was in middle school. He didn't know how to order food at McDonald's. That's ridiculous. You know, these are the kind of things where you got to teach them stuff like how to shop. I mean, by the time I was like 7 or 8 years old, I was shopping by myself, and I'd learned things like you don't touch it unless you're going to buy it. And you've got to take kids out in the community and just have them do these things. So you take them into the McDonald's when the McDonald's is not busy, and they have to learn how to order food. I mean, they've got to learn these just daily living skills. There's not enough emphasis on that kind of stuff.
And that will really help them with the social interaction as well, it would seem.
They've got to learn how to talk to the person behind the counter correctly.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that it's important to prepare kids for the job world. I wondered, do you have any suggestions for preparing them for secondary education? If we were a high school teacher, how would we prepare them, or any suggestions for preparing?
You mean like going to college or something like that?
Yes, or post-secondary education, either if it's technical college or perhaps it's a four-year college. Anything we can do to prepare them?
One of the things, I think they need to be visiting the place because you want to get rid of the surprises. You know, and so, you know, a few years before they're going to, you know, graduate from high school, they need to go out and visit the technical school and so they can get turned on about the great things they can learn there. Because the thing that got me turned around in school and studying and going from being an awful student to being a good student who studied is I now had the goal of becoming a scientist. So if you take the child out and show him how cool it would be to become an auto mechanic, now maybe he'll be motivated to study in school. But he needs to go out and he needs to see these places. So there's a goal, because you want to take that intense motivation that these kids have and get them fixated on having the goal of, you know, having a career like being an auto mechanic. And the thing that's wonderful about that job is it's not going to get outsourced. And I've just been reading a galley proof for a new book that John Robinson's coming out with. And he talks in the end about how he, got his jobs you know, he was introduced to auto mechanics. He became an auto mechanic, but when he was in high school, he used to go visit the university labs, and it was wonderful. He was allowed to do this. It was probably kind of illegal, but good. But that's what got him turned around. And got him turned around is he got to go out to the university labs and get to play with really fun electronic equipment. You see, this is, we've got to get kids in doing these things.
Excellent. You mentioned a couple of things while you were presenting. You mentioned some books, and I wondered if you would just give us a tip on where we could find them.
Well,
yes, go ahead.
Okay, well, my book's Thinking in Pictures and the Way I See It. You can usually buy those at any Barnes & Noble store. All of my books are available on Amazon.com. The Tito Macapatahe book, How Can I Talk My Lips Don't Move, you probably will have to buy off of Amazon or one of the other book sites. Thinking in Pictures and the Way I See It, You can order them through Future Horizons or Amazon, or they'd be at Barnes & Noble or Borders, and they can order them. Any book can be gotten off of book websites. There's no excuse to say you can't find a book. If you know the title of a book or the author of a book, you can find it on Amazon or one of the other book websites.
Great. Okay, thank you. And I just, one final thing, I just wanted to say congratulations on the movie, receiving an Emmy. And if anyone who's listening has not seen the movie, I hope that they seek it out and find it and watch it. It's really well done.
And if you
and
want
I'm
to buy
assuming
the movie,
you feel the same way.
Oh, yeah, and if you want to buy the movie, the title is Temple Grandin, and it is available on Amazon.
Excellent. I can't say thank you enough for your wonderful suggestions today, Temple. It really has helped us know how to work with children who have these special needs and also young adults. And I'm assuming adults if we work with such folks who have signs of autism or Asperger's syndrome, we know better now how to work with them as our colleagues. So
well,
thank you for sharing all of that with us.
Again, of course, that autism is a very, very big, broad spectrum, going from someone that's going to remain nonverbal up to the geniuses. And where I think service providers are having the most difficult time is a lot of them know what to do with the more severely afflicted kids, but they don't know what to do with the smart Aspies. And some of these are falling through the cracks and ending up on welfare and not getting into good jobs. It's sort of like two different kinds of ways. You have somebody that is nonverbal is not going to be an auto mechanic or designing computers in Silicon Valley, obviously. But I'm seeing kids that are really smart that should be designing computers in Silicon Valley being trained to do janitorial work, and that's wrong.
Mm-hmm. Good. Just an excellent point. Excellent.
All right. Well, and on behalf of SpeechPathology.com, I would like to thank Temple Grandin as well as Linda Schreiber and Chris Rutherford for this fantastic interview that was brought to us today. Certainly some wonderful suggestions and just love the firsthand experiences that Temple shared with us. So thank you so much to everybody for providing that for us this afternoon. Please don't forget that this conference is running for the entire week with presentations every day. Please check the SpeechPathology.com homepage, as we would love to have you join us. Thank you so much, everybody.